Al Jazeera Podcasts.
The first senior Israeli official has resigned over Hamas's October attack. The military intelligence chief took responsibility for major security failures. What message does it send during Israel's war on Gaza? And could it be the first step towards accountability? I'm Mohammed Jamjoum, and you're listening to the Inside Story podcast, where we dissect, analyze, and help define major global stories. All right, let's go ahead and bring in our panel in London. Daniel Levy is the president of the U.S. Middle East Project. He advised Ehud Barak when he served as Israeli prime minister. In Sydney, Australia, Anthony Lowenstein is the author of the recently published book, The Palestine Laboratory, a global investigation into how Israel's occupation has provided a testing ground for weapons and technology exported globally. And in Tel Aviv, Gideon Levy is a columnist for the Haaretz newspaper and the author of The Punishment of Gaza, a book about the development of the Israeli policy that led to the 2009 invasion of the Gaza Strip. A warm welcome to you all, and thanks so much for joining us today on Inside Story. Daniel, let me start with you today. So, military intelligence chief Aharon Haliva has become the first senior Israeli official to resign over failures to prevent the October 7th attack. I'm curious about the timing. Why step down now, and will this set the stage for more resignations?
I cannot speak to that question of timing. There are rumors regarding one of his deputies having to have left for health issues, which may have actually delayed Haliva's departure. There is certainly speculation, and there has been for some time, that some of the security military chiefs who have very early on stated their intention that they would not continue after the end of this war. I think it's clear that Netanyahu is looking at a long war, a forever war, perhaps. That they would step down. I think for some, this was intended to build pressure on the prime minister. It may be that some now feel that there is no pressure on the prime minister and that this is a way of trying to generate that. Of course, there's no serious undertaking of a commission of inquiry, but I think one can get lost in those granular details and miss the big picture, which is that whether it's inside the military or the political class, the ability to seriously reflect on not just what happened on that day, and this is the crucial thing. If one focuses narrowly on this idea that there was an intelligence failure, and it almost captures the essence of everything that's wrong with the way this is looked at, that the intel chief has gone first. Because the problem isn't one of intel in that narrow security military sense. The problem is intelligence. In terms of the broad word, if you looked it up in a dictionary, intelligence, being intelligent, not being stupid. And the idea that you could keep Palestinians in this situation without rights, without enfranchisement, without freedoms, under occupation, under an apartheid regime, and that this would deliver security, that's not a question of whether the intel flows were working properly. That's a basic stupidity that will never hold.
Anthony, I saw you reacting to what Daniel was saying there, so I want to let you jump in. But I also want to ask you, what message does this send while the war on Gaza continues?
Well, I'd say to the Israeli public, who are increasingly disillusioned with the war, not very strong. I mean, as Daniel rightly says, if one looks at intelligence in a very narrow sense, then October 7 was a catastrophe for Israel. But in the broader sense, this was far bigger than that. And what I mean by that is that for many, many years, many in the Israeli public, this is not just a government and intelligence failure, many in the Israeli public were sold, convinced, I would say hoodwinked, into believing that Gazans, 2.3 million of them, could be caged indefinitely without any kind of serious response. And along the Gaza-Israel fence, there has been huge amounts of Israeli companies that have spent lots of money, billions and billions of dollars, something I look at in my book, trying to protect Israel from Gazans, which clearly failed miserably. And it's interesting to note, many of those companies that failed so miserably on that day, their technology failed, their site failed, are selling and testing weapons in Gaza as we speak to foreign buyers. In other words, an intelligence chief can leave, can resign, other people may follow. None of that will change the fact that at the end of this war, whenever that happens, Israel will be less safe than it was on October the 6th.
Gideon, in Haliva's resignation letter, he wrote that authority comes with responsibility, and that's being interpreted by many in Israel as a suggestion that it may be time for Prime Minister Netanyahu that he go ahead and resign. Do you believe that Haliva was intending to send that signal that it's time for Netanyahu to face accountability?
It might very be. Haliva is quite a political guy with a lot of friends in the political environment which protests against Netanyahu. But, you know, Haliva is not in a position to tell others what to do. I'm not surprised that he's resigning. I'm surprised he's resigning only now because he couldn't function ever since the 7th of October. How can he function ever since then? Who would listen to him? And if someone would listen to him, what kind of responsibility is it to listen to such a failure? So Haliva, together with all the generals, must go. And in the same time, I totally agree to Anthony and Daniel, namely that the failure of the 7th is just a small failure. This does not mean that people who are responsible for this failure shouldn't go away. The big failure is still untouched in Israel. Israel did not draw any lessons from the 7th. Israel still believes, and maybe more intensively, in the old beliefs that we can continue with the occupation, continue with the apartheid, and we can live on our sword, only on our sword forever.
Gideon, let me just follow up with you and ask you about the fact that Haliva also called for the establishment of a state committee to fully investigate the failings that led to the assault on October 7th. Is that something we're going to see happen at any point soon?
Even if we'll see it, Muhammad, don't expect too much from it. Those investigation committees in Israel, first of all, their work lasts for months and years until no one remembers what was the cause of their establishment. And then they are always vague and never put it, this is the experience until now. Maybe we will now invent a new kind of committee, of investigation committee. But everyone who speaks about investigation committee means to postpone everything until the investigation will be concluded, which will be years' time. There is very little to investigate here. Things are so clear. There was no army on the 7th. There was no intelligence on the 7th. And Israel is occupying Gaza and the West Bank for decades without having any solution and any intention to put an end to it.
Daniel, I can see you reacting as well to what Gideon is saying there. So I'm going to give you the chance to go ahead and jump in as well. Go ahead.
Well, I always enjoy, if that's the right word, listening to Gideon. And this is the point. I don't think people should have expectations from what an investigation within that structure, within that system can come up with, because the questions will not be the questions that need to be asked. Yes, there'll be things about, you know, was material that was passed on taken seriously, but it's that granular detail which is the least important lesson to learn, because the questions that one can almost be guaranteed will not be on the table are the questions of what are the root causes? How do we treat the Palestinians? And here, you know, I think sometimes we get Bibiitis. We make this so much about Netanyahu. It's a system. It's a systemic structural violence thing that the political class and the military are all caught up in. When you do hear people say, well, there's got to be diplomacy. Fine, that's right. But if the diplomacy on offer is nothing more than how one manages this system of occupation and apartheid, then that's not actually an alternative. So the question won't be on the table of whether Israel's process of having security collaboration with a Palestinian authority in the West Bank that has no credibility with its people, of trying to blockade Gaza indefinitely because you think perhaps you can domesticate Hamas, of a regional set of relations which are built on, I would argue, a castle of sands. You know, what have these normalization Abraham Accord agreements done for Israel in practice? All they've taught the Israelis is this idea, a false idea, that things are okay. If we make peace with some people in the Gulf, we can continue to keep the Palestinians in this condition. So the crucial questions that need to be asked will not be asked. And what Anthony said earlier is really important, because one of the signals this sends is that this so-called startup nation, high-tech power, has been exposed for its vulnerabilities and its failures, and the world is seeing this. And the world is seeing that Israel is not managing asymmetric warfare effectively because Hamas, and I would argue some of the other resistance axis actors, are showing that you can turn the power of Israel on itself, because when Israel responds in this hugely disproportionate way, it is in fact undermining its own equities, whether they be legal, moral, deterrence, etc.
So, Anthony, if we can pick up on what Daniel was saying there, and I saw you nodding your head, responding to some of what he was saying there. If there is this system in place, what happens in the event that there are more resignations? Let's say at some point that Netanyahu's political career comes to an end. Many people in Israel are calling for him to resign. If we get to a scenario whereby that actually happens, or if there are new elections, what happens thereafter?
I wish I could say the outcome would be very different. Netanyahu, on current polling, would probably lose an election, but his likely successor, Benny Gantz, is virtually no different on Gaza, on the occupation, on any accountability. Just this week, the US has announced possible sanctions on a particularly extreme element of the IDF who've committed huge crimes in the West Bank. Benny Gantz's response was equal outrage, along with Netanyahu. In other words, if we expect there to be radical change when a different prime minister comes into office, we'll be disappointed. And this goes, I think, to the broader point that accountability within Israel over decades has barely existed. In other words, there's barely been any soldiers, let alone generals, actually held to account for crimes committed in the West Bank or Gaza. The only way I would argue this will really ever change, and I would argue similarly with the US, with its behaviour in Iraq and Afghanistan in the last 20 or so years, are international trials of soldiers or generals or politicians before an international court, the Hague, for example. That shows there will be a cost, a price for committing crimes in Gaza or the West Bank. And it's worth saying finally that we can investigate, or Israel can investigate, the 7th of October as much as it wants. How about what's happened in the last 6 months? The 7th of October, in my view, was a crime. But what's been happening in the last 6 months? 35, 45, 50,000 potential Palestinians killed, the vast majority of whom are civilians. There will be no investigation within Israel for those Palestinians who have been killed. And without accountability in an international forum or court, nothing, and Gideon has been writing this relentlessly for years, but especially since October 7, Israeli culture within the public, forget about the military or intelligence, there's a bloodlust. And without accountability globally, sadly, this will not change.
Gideon, you heard Anthony there talk about the fact that you've written extensively about what you call a bloodlust in Israeli society. And that's something that I wanted to ask you specifically about. It's been a theme in a lot of your writing. In one of your more recent columns, you wrote that it's doubtful there has ever been so much thirst for blood and war in Israel. And I'm curious to get your thoughts about how, at this particular moment, when there is a lot of condemnation of Netanyahu, and polling suggests that he's at an all-time low when it comes to credibility, trust from the public, popularity, how much is the fact that what you're calling this bloodlust existing in Israeli society, how much is that helping him and his cohorts in government?
Unfortunately, it helps him a lot, because the 7th of October took the Israelis out of the closet or changed their minds. But in any case, after the 7th of October, the Israelis feel that everything is legitimate, that Israel has the right to do whatever it wants, no limits, no international law, no humanity, nothing. Most of the Israelis feel that Gaza deserves this punishment, and most of the Israelis think that Israel didn't cross any line by killing so many civilians. Now, Netanyahu is just a figure in all these processes, but it's not all about Netanyahu. I obviously totally agree to Anthony, who said that Benny Gantz will not be any better, and no one of the potential candidates in Israel will be any better, only because of the simple reason that there is quite a consensus in Israeli society. It is always described as very divided. Yes, they are very divided about minority. they are very, very united, much too united about the basic issues, namely continuing the occupation, going to this war. Look how Israelis support this war, even after 6 months of failures. So supporting the war, continuing the occupation, continuing the apartheid gets always big, big rates in any poll in Israel of support of really one opinion, which says, much more so after the 7th, one opinion which says we have the right to do whatever we want and nobody will tell us what to do.
Daniel, I've spent quite a bit of time over the course of the past year reporting from Israel. Before October 7th, I was reporting on the judicial overhaul protests, where you saw a lot of anger directed toward the Netanyahu government plan to try to overhaul the judiciary. Now, after October 7th, there have been these protests that have been increasing. First, it was the family of captives that are being held in Gaza. Now there are more explicit anti-government demonstrations. And I'm curious to get your thoughts about if you think that these different protest movement will coalesce against around sort of an overall anger towards Netanyahu and how that impacts him specifically at a time when his popularity is at an all-time low, when people are so angry at him, when there are government officials that are saying they're taking responsibility for the intelligence failure that led to October 7th, but Netanyahu has continued to say he's not taking responsibility, that he'll answer tough questions, but it'll be later.
Well, Mohammed, I followed some of that reporting that you undertook. Yes, the protests have increased in intensity in recent weeks, somewhat less since this mini-escalation with Iran. There was anger over the extent to which Netanyahu has deprioritized the hostage issue. There was the return to some of that division that we saw prior to October 7th. And it may well be that Netanyahu is in trouble politically. The polling is not looking good for him, but there's no election on the horizon. And this is one of the reasons why Netanyahu is a particularly dangerous leader at the moment, beyond what we have gotten used to, because it seems that his own political future is tied in to the continuing of the war. But I think it's really crucial to not lose sight of what's been mentioned, which is that if you zoom out, the question of Netanyahu is a very effective politician. He's very effective regionally, internationally. We can't take that away from him. But the path that he has set out is really quite consensual. And, you know, if one goes back to October 7th, and absolutely that was a violation of international law, preceded by Israel's violations, continued afterwards. The one of the things that made that possible and makes the failings possible is if you dehumanize the other side, if you hold them in such contempt, then that puts you on the path to the kind of hubris which I think led to these failures in what happened. And, you know, the fact that Israel is at the International Court of Justice plausibly violating the Genocide Convention, the fact that a UN Special Rapporteur can write a report, Francesca Albanese, The Anatomy of a Genocide, shows how much deeper than Netanyahu this goes. The former Labour leader, who's the president of Israel, Isaac Herzog, he's the first person the ICJ quoted in terms of incitement to genocide. And I believe, because the question that hangs in the air is whether it's Netanyahu or not, how does one envisage possible change, a possible different dynamic, where we're not all sitting here saying it's not just Netanyahu, it's not just Gantz, it's almost the entirety of the Zionist political class. So I think there's a problem here in terms of the project, in terms of whether Zionism can do what's written on the tin and deliver security for Jewish Israelis. It has failed to do that. It's obviously delivered devastation for Palestinians. How does that begin to change? That's where one gets into the question of impunity. Because unless Israel's cost-benefit calculation looks different, unless Israel is held accountable, I'm not saying that would force Israelis to change, but it means that Israelis start to ask the questions of, is it worth it to treat the Palestinians like this? If the answer is you can get away with anything, then the question of if it's worth it doesn't even get asked.
Gideon, I saw you reacting to what Daniel was saying there. It looked like you wanted to jump in. Please go ahead.
No, we are all agreeing more or less on the point that focusing on Netanyahu is a mistake. I claim it now for years when the Israeli protest is demonstrating, my best friends, they are demonstrating against Netanyahu. This is fair enough, this is just, but it's not the point. And I tell you more than this, pay attention to the protests in Israel. None of them is protesting against the war. None of them is protesting against the mass killing of Gaza. None of them is protesting against the starvation, the killing children, the uprooted people, the refugees. None of them is mentioned. It's only about getting rid of Netanyahu. It is very easy to see Netanyahu as the big Satan, which he is in many ways. But hey, what are you suggesting instead of him? Whom are you suggesting instead of him? Do you really touch the core of the problem? Or you found yourself your comfort life by pointing out Netanyahu, if you just get rid of him, Israel will turn back to become the paradise that we dreamt about. So my answer is, guys, that's not the point.
Yeah, Daniel, I mean, Gideon's making a good point there. The fact is that in poll after poll in Israel, it's reflected that while most Israelis want to see Netanyahu go, most of them are also still supporting the war effort, correct?
And exactly, and that's it's a convenient story that some in the West, some of Israel's enablers in the US are telling themselves. So Chuck Hagel, the Democrat lead in the Senate, gives this speech considered path-breaking, but it really boils down to, if only there was no Netanyahu, things would be okay. The Biden administration sometimes seems to echo this kind of thinking. It's a really convenient, really mistaken way to look at this. It's an easy place to go because no one wants to actually challenge the root causes of this. And unless you do, you're not going to get anywhere. You know, Netanyahu's successor may be better, may be worse, but it's systemic. One has to address that systemic problem.
Anthony, if we're talking about systemic issues within Israel and the Israeli government, one of the questions that continues to be asked in the wake of this resignation is this a first step towards accountability in Israel? But if you're talking about accountability, that looks different depending on who you're asking, right? I mean, you have accountability in Israel towards the Israeli people with regards to the failures that led to the October 7th attack. But then you have what many in the international community are calling for, which is accountability for atrocities committed in Gaza. Isn't that right?
For sure. And essentially, Israel is both unwilling and incapable of doing so within its own legal system. They've shown that for years and years. And I think the question that we're talking about really goes to a more existential one for Israel. It was an interesting piece last week in the New York Times written by Benny Morris, the right-wing Israeli historian who I don't agree with on pretty much anything, but he said something very interesting within that. He supported going into Rafah and all these terrible things, but he said something, and I'm paraphrasing here, words to the effect of, it's pretty inarguable that it is the most unsafe place in the world to be Jewish these days is Israel. Now, what does that tell you about Israel 75 years or so after its birth, that of course, anti-Semitism is real, and some places in the world, undeniably, it's a growing problem. But if a so-called respected, again, someone I don't really agree with, but someone who is a member of the Israeli establishment, argues and says that point, almost as a throwaway line, this goes far, far deeper than Netanyahu or, frankly, any political leader in Israel. This goes to an existential question of Israel's future, that the whole so-called dream of Zionism, as Daniel said, was to provide safety for Jews. And clearly, and I would argue almost impossible to argue against this, it is not safe for Jews now. And I would argue long before October 7, and certainly in the last 6 months, it's even gotten more unsafe for Jews within Israel. And I would argue in the global diaspora. This is the problem Israel faces. And without international pressure, which I think will start to build, the US and London are not going to be pushing for arms embargoes, but certain states will. And sanctions, and trying to put Israeli soldiers on trial in the coming years. That will happen, or at least attempts will for that to happen. And this is where the game can change.
All right. Well, we have run out of time, so we're going to have to leave the conversation there. Thanks so much to our guests, Daniel Levy, Anthony Lowenstein, and Gideon Levy. This episode was produced by Mohammed Al-Aishi, Axel Zaimovich, Veronica Pedrosa, and Gemma Harries. Studio sound was by Dragan Vrankovic. The program was edited by Manish Mathai, Zainab Badr, and Joe DeFrias. Be sure to subscribe to the Inside Story podcast to catch every episode. Thank you for listening. Tune in on Wednesday for our next edition.
Coming up on The Take, a State Department panel made recommendations to sanction certain Israeli military units for rights abuses. Why did it take months for the U.S. to act? That's The Take by Al Jazeera. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.